history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that just need to be told, and we never hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen as we honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to make sure we preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Like the one we're going to hear today in Seattle, Washington, from a guy who's lived here almost all of his 97 years. Al Skerritt is our guest, and it's a good thing he made it to 97, because something has happened in the last year that was pretty unbelievable. We're going to hear about that. But let's start out early on. You were actually not born in the United States. You're born in Canada, in Alberta, with four siblings?
Five kids, and my dad came down. He got a job building the St. Vincent home as a carpenter. So when he got enough money, well, then he sent for my mother to come down, and she came down on the train with five children. I remember getting off the train. I was fussy, and my mother gave me a pillow to carry, and that kind of settled me down. We moved to West Seattle, and my dad rented a house just below the junction at California and Alaska Street. I took a look at that house. My gosh, it looked like a mansion because I came from a little small house on the prairie in Canada. Anyway, I grew up in just below California Avenue and Alaska Street. Then we moved up on 35th and Myrtle Street. I went to ECU school, and I had to walk to school. We didn't have buses in those days. And one of the neat things that happened to me, I walked by the fire station on 35th and Othello Street, and all the firemen knew me because I walked by their station every day, but I never knew I was going to be a firefighter myself. But these firemen always treated me good, and then I got a paper route delivering the Seattle Star. I delivered it to the fire station. I had to collect money from them. And I'm not sure just what it cost a month, but it was right around $1 a month. The firemen all knew me because my dog would come up at a certain time and sit on the corner waiting for me to show up. And I don't know how they knew the time, the dog, but it was there every day for me. And he knew my route. I'd follow my dog instead of him following me. But it was really something, living up on the hill. And one day at school, we heard that Old Ironsides was coming to Seattle. This other kid, Earl Vance, and I, we climbed up to the top of the water tank where the ball is up there to see if we could see Old Ironsides come into Seattle. Of course, we couldn't see it, so then we climbed down again, but it was a dangerous thing that we did. We climbed clear up to the very top where the ball is.
And I'm curious, too, about your childhood. With a big family like that, with you and four siblings, and your parents had actually come to Canada from Norway, were you speaking Norwegian in the home growing up as much as English, or did you learn a little bit?
No, I just knew probably a few words. They didn't try to teach me Norwegian.
Do you remember those childhood years having a dream, an ambition, a thought, hey, when I grow up, here's what I want to do and here's what I want to be?
No, I was just good at doing whatever came up. I could always make things, and I was just born with the ability to do things.
So you get on into high school. Were you playing sports in high school, or were you too busy working for that? What were you doing?
Well, I turned out for football, and before I got the job of being a football player, a freshman team, Well, I got a job in a drugstore after school, so I quit sports. And I worked 4 years in this drugstore, and I earned 30 cents an hour. It was one of the best educations I ever had, because people would come in and ask me for the different things, and I learned where they were. And the druggist really trusted me very much when I got to know the drugstore good. And when he would go out to lunch or something, well, he'd give me a phone number to call if I needed help or if somebody came to get a prescription filled. But it was really something. Here I was just 16 years old. I was in charge of a drugstore. It is kind of nice to be nice looking, and I guess I was, because the girls did like me. And I remember one day I was out in the park, Hiawatha Park. It's across the street from the high school. It was lunchtime. I was laying on a lawn with this girl, and I had my head in her lap. And she was playing with my hair, and I thought, well, she likes my wavy hair. When I went back to botany class, well, the kids were pointing at me and laughing. I didn't know what this laughing about. They said, well, put your hand on your head. And I did that, and here, this girl had bobby pinned all my waves. And that's why the kids were kind of laughing at me. But I didn't know. I thought she was just admiring my waves in my hair.
She pulled one over on you. You know, and it's, for a lot of people, they think of Seattle, and some of the first things that come to mind, you know, would be the Space Needle, or the Seahawks, or the Mariners. None of that was here when you were growing up. During the Great Depression, did you feel the depression here in Seattle? Were you aware that things weren't as they should be?
Yes, I remember when I was in high school, and for a nickel, you could get on the streetcar, they would take you clear downtown, and then that was a nickel to get back home. But for $1, you could take a girl to a show downtown. I think it was only 10 cents for a show. Afterwards, you could treat her to dessert or something. I'd take her to a coffee shop, which the coffee was only 5 cents. Well, you're really sending me back in my mind. I should have thought about these things before. But, oh, there was one place downtown I liked to go, and I liked buttermilk. And for 5 cents, you could drink all the buttermilk you wanted.
Let me ask you about this, because everybody seems to remember something. But December 7th, 1941, do you remember where you were and how you heard that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I was a machinist. I just finished my apprenticeship of being a machinist. I remember them saying about the Japanese. It was a short time after that. The machine shop I worked in was Marking Machinery. They were making things for the merchant ships. And when that was over, well, I lost my job.
And that job carried with it a deferment from military service because it was related to the war effort. We'll come back around to that. But by the time that happened and you went into the Navy, you were already married. So I got to hear, how'd you meet your wife?
You know, I went to a dance out at Angle Lake, and there was a fence around the dance floor, and they had a couple of openings where you bought tickets to dance. And the dance, it cost you 5 cents. And so I had this one ticket, and I was walking around the gate, and I was looking at all the girls to see which girl I should take. But they were all leaning on a fence that fenced in the dance floor. And all I could see was their backs. And I saw this one cute little girl, and she looked like she should look good when she turned around. I asked this girl to dance, and here it was my wife. I mean, future.
Yeah.
So I danced with her, and I got her phone number and all that. And then I phoned her up, and she was always busy. So one time I phoned her, and she says, yes, I'll go out with you if you take me to a dinner dance. That's where it all started. She liked me, and I liked her.
So the only reason she wanted to go to the dance was so she could wear her sister's fur coat? Is that the truth?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's a good thing that fur coat existed then. It did you a favor. How long was it till you guys got married?
Well, I started to go out with her, and I liked her very much. We'd go out to a place called Angle Lake I rented a boat, and I said, I want you to row the boat. And so she rowed it out a ways, and I said, well, you can stop here. I said, I got something to give you. And I says, but what I give you, don't drop it. And here I gave her the engagement ring. And here I made her row the boat out, so give her the engagement ring.
And that was smart, because where's she going to go if she's stuck in a boat in the middle of the lake, right?
Well, I just thought it would be something that would be different, you know.
I mean, she couldn't say no. I mean, she's not sure she's going to get back to shore if she says no, right?
Yes. Well, I kind of knew that she would say yes.
So you meet this girl, you get married, you guys even have your first child, you had a son, and then you decided to go in the Navy. What was that about? What encouraged you or convinced you to join the Navy?
When they took away my deferment, well, then I knew I had to join, so I joined the Navy.
So the deferment disappeared, and you knew you had to be in the service somewhere.
Yes, I thought the Navy was the best, because my dad was a sailor in Norway, and even took one trip to Italy, and they went down there with a lot of lutefisk and that on the boat, and on the way my dad tattooed his left hand because he was right-handed, but he made a little anchor of a ship, and I always liked that tattoo.
Well, so that had been implanted in your consciousness at a very young age, your dad's anchor tattoo. So the Navy was a natural for you. And we're going to hear about how you ended up on the aircraft carrier, the USS Bunker Hill, which some people have heard about. They know what happened to it at the end of the war. But that wasn't the first assignment the Navy had for you. What'd you do at first?
They called it the Armed Guard, and we went aboard a merchant ship, and we were the gunnery crew. We had a 3-inch cannon. Then we had a lot of machine guns and that along different places on the ship. And we were to protect the ship. I took one trip to Hawaii. Then they sent me to Treasure Island in San Francisco. That's where I got my assignment to this aircraft carrier. They had a busload of sailors. We went down to the pier, and I saw this ship, and it really kind of scared me because it was so big. I took a look at it, and I looked up and up and up and up, and then I finally came up to the flight deck, and my gosh, that ship was so big it scared me, really. But that was my ship. Seeing that I was a machinist, they gave me a pretty good rate right off the start. I was a third-class petty officer, and the first job I had, I really liked, because I went up to officer's country. There was a leak in a pipe up there. Well, here I saw this guy sitting in a chair, and he didn't have any identification on his collar. And so I didn't know what to call him, but I had to have him move. And so I thought, well, quickly I just said, I called him a chief. I said, say, chief, you got to move, because I got to fix this leaking pipe. It's behind your chair. I know that he got up grinning from ear to ear, and I don't know, I think he says, okay, sailor, or something. Then I found out afterwards that was Admiral Mitcher. He was in charge of the whole Fifth Fleet. And I kind of really think that that little story, I bet you he tells that story also. I'd be calling him a chief.
Well, and good thing he had a sense of humor. Because maybe one of the other admirals would have let you have it, huh?
Well, that could be, but everybody liked Admiral Mitcher anyway. I always remember that he was kind of a small guy. He wasn't a big guy, but I remember when they, right after we got hit by the kamikazes, well, they took him off the ship and placed him elsewhere to operate that area.
And that was May 11th of 1945, but you were on the ship for a while before that. And you mentioned being a machinist. I mean, you're talking about having to fix plumbing leaks. What else were you doing on the ship?
I was in charge of the CO2 shop. I had six guys in my crew, and I would give them jobs of checking all the fire extinguishers and all that on board ship. Seeing I was a machinist, I had a lathe and a drill press and acetylene torches and all that, and I knew how to operate all that. I made jewelry. I would make different things that the other sailors would buy from me so I could send money home to my wife.
You mentioned your wife. So here you are on this ship, you're heading out into the Pacific, your wife is at home, you've got an infant son at home. Does it ever occur to you that your life is in danger, that there's a chance you might never see your wife or get to see your son grow up?
Yes, but I always remember the day that we got bombed. I was on a night watch. My watch was 3 o'clock in the morning, and shortly after that, we got hit.
As far as your wife and your son, was that something you thought about? I mean, did you live with a fear of not making it back or maybe not surviving this war?
I never thought about I would be killed or anything, but I knew it was dangerous. Oh, I'd like to start down where I saved this guy from Chicago.
Well, and I don't want to miss anything along the way. Before we talk about all that, of May 11th off of Okinawa. You also have a battle star. You're wearing it on your hat right now for the Battle of Iwo Jima.
We sent our planes out to bomb Iwo Jima to help the soldiers on the ground. And then when that was secure, well, then we moved to Okinawa. That was the time when we got bombed. They sent out the kamikaze planes.
Yeah, so this is May 11th, 1945 now, and you said you're on a watch. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You had headphones on. For what purpose?
I had headphones on because I was in charge of a couple of different areas up there. I had a lot of controls.
And where was this on the ship, where you were?
I was on the second deck down. Our ship got hit by these kamikazes.
What did that feel like where you were?
I was getting a report on my earphones and all that. We shot down one kamikaze and the other two hit the ship. I knew where they had hit because I could hear on my earphones what happened. Oh, I heard this pounding on this escape hatch, and it was from the engine room. And I opened up the escape hatch, and here there was a sailor. He was rum-dum, and he wanted to get out, and I tried to help him out, but he was too heavy. And so I saw another sailor walking by, and I asked him to come over and help me. And he helped me get this guy out of this escape hatch. And this sailor told me, he says, you know, he says, there's a first aid station now in the forward part of the ship. I could take this guy up there, and I said, oh, please do. And I gave this guy to take up to the first aid station. Oh, this officer was there, and I heard this pounding on this here hatchway. I wanted to open up this gangway, and this officer was there. He says, don't you touch that. He says, we're to keep everything locked down. And we heard this pounding, and I wanted to open it because there was somebody on the other side wanting to get out. When we did open it, it was a terrible sight. There was a pile of, not just a few guys, but there was guys piled on top of one another. They'd come to the end of the driveway. I guess they couldn't see, but they had an object to climb over, and then they'd die on top. But we did open the door, the hatchway. There was a pile of sailors dead, not just one or two, but I would say there was five or six on top of one another trying to get further on.
And so people understand, you wanted to open it because you know there's someone there, but they wouldn't let you because of the fire risk? Was that the issue?
Or the explosion.
So you could, by trying to save them, you could kill a whole bunch more?
Yes, the officer wouldn't let me open up that hatch until things quieted down.
War puts young men in situations no one should ever have to face. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old Al Skerritt. Check out the photos of him online at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you can also link to a book about the attack on the USS Bunker Hill. That book would end up connecting Al to that disoriented sailor he saved from the engine room 72 years ago. We'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 97-year-old Al Skerritt of Seattle, Washington. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, in addition to photos of Al, you'll find a video from WGN-TV in Chicago. It's a phenomenal piece that details how a book by the youngest son of Robert F. Kennedy eventually led to Al getting to talk to the sailor whose life he saved on the USS Bunker Hill 72 years ago. We'll talk to Al about it in a bit, and I hope to catch up with that man he saved, Norm Lasman, on a future episode of Hometown Heroes. But let's pick it up where we left off. It was May 11th, 1945. The carrier was supporting the invasion of Okinawa, and in the early morning hours, a kamikaze attack claimed the lives of nearly 400 men aboard the Bunker Hill. The first Zero dropped a bomb that crashed through the flight deck and out the side of the ship before exploding in the ocean, and the Japanese pilot then crashed his plane onto the flight deck, smashing into American planes loaded with fuel and ammunition and igniting a fire and a series of explosions. 30 seconds later, another Zero dove at the Bunker Hill, plowing through anti-aircraft fire and dropping a 550-pound bomb before crashing into the deck. The bomb made it down through the deck before exploding in the pilot's ready room, setting off more explosions and just adding to the chaos and the devastation. You heard Al Skerritt describe how he pulled one disoriented sailor from the engine room after hearing loud banging from the other side of the hatch. You heard him say how an officer later stopped him from opening a different hatch because the risk of fire and explosion was too great. Later on, Al would see the pile of bodies stacked against the hatch that he had been ordered not to open. But there was another opportunity to potentially save lives that came Al's way, and this time it nearly cost him his life.
This other officer came down there, and he heard about me getting this one guy out of this here hatch from the engine room. He says, Al, we're going to go down there. And he says, we put on some oxygen service masks. The canister would generate oxygen for 1 hour. And so this officer and I, we climbed down the hatchway to the engine room. And it was so dark down there with smoke and that, you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face. This officer disappeared. I didn't know where he went. And so I knew I couldn't see anything down there. The smoke was so thick. So I leaned up against the bulkhead and just waited, thinking that he would come back and get me, but he never did. And then I knew my oxygen was running out of my mask. And so I said a prayer. I said, God, help me. I took one or maybe two steps. I held my hand out in front of me so I wouldn't bump into anything, but my hand grasped a railing, and I knew it was a ladder. And I looked up, and I saw this really bright light way up high. It looked to me like the moon. But anyway, I got on this ladder, and I climbed up there. And here there was a sailor holding a battle lantern down, and he bawled me out. He says, "Where the heck have you been? Your officer left a long time ago, and he told me for me to stay here until you came up." And I thanked him for that. Then I went up to my locker, opened up my locker, and when I opened up my locker, there was a picture of my 2-year-old son, and I cried. Another sailor walked by, and they saw me crying. And he patted me on the shoulder, and he says, "Well, the same thing happened to me. I had people at home, and I cried when I got okay. I knew that I was strong enough and well enough to still do things on the ship. So I went up on the flight deck. They were trying to get a fire out in the forward part of the ship because night was coming on, and they wanted to get that fire out because that would be like a beacon where the enemy could find us. Here, there was a group of guys. They put on these 1-hour masks, and this one guy, his name was Spider. I don't know why I remember that name. But he tried to get the mask on. He said, no, this mask doesn't fit. I can't go in there. And so then the officer, he took the mask. He looked around, and I happened to be standing there, and he pushed the mask to me. He says, "You're going in." And so I put on the mask, and I climbed down to the next deck down. They put a lead-in line on my back. Then they gave me an 1.5-inch fire hose. We were supposed to go back in and put this fire out. And when we got back there, well, the hose was too short, so we came back and they put more line on this hose, another 50 feet. We started to go in again, and the lead-in line was too short. So we came back out, and then the officer says, "No, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to go in to the top and go down to get that fire out." And then they found out that this was a electrical panel, a 440 voltage. And if we had put water on it and we were wading in 2 or 3 inches of water, we would have been electrocuted. But that didn't happen.
Well, back to when this started. You said they told you on your headphones what had happened and where the damage was. And I know that's a big ship.
Yes.
But did you feel it when the kamikazes hit?
Oh, sure. The deck was loaded with our airplanes, loaded, and our planes were loaded with bombs. And it was all ready to go out and strike Okinawa.
So when those kamikazes hit, it started a chain reaction, and this damage was severe. There's fire all over the place. There are explosions. And you're getting a little piece of that picture at a time, I imagine.
Yes. I kind of knew what happened because I told you I had earphones on.
Yeah. But you didn't know that nearly 400 men were going to lose their lives in this and that hundreds more would be wounded.
Well, that's true. I remember going up on the deck, down below, and all these here guys piled on one another when we opened up the hatch, and they were dead, wanting to find fresh air. Everything I tell you, it has to come maybe a little bit slow, but I want to tell the truth.
Well, I've got a few thoughts here. One, this was a really long day. I mean, if this starts at 3 a.m. and you're still at it, you're fighting the fire at almost dusk. I mean, I bet at the end of that day you had to be just exhausted.
Well, yes, that's true. I was exhausted. And I went around the ship to see what else I could do. I followed this officer. And this one thing that was really kind of bad, I got up to one deck and there was a leg laying on the deck. this one guy says, oh, that we haven't thrown that overboard. That came from that kamikaze. And he picked up that leg and gave it a heave over the side. Oh, and yes, I forgot, the pilot of the kamikaze, his body was laying there. And this one guy says, oh, look at that ring. And he tried to get the ring off of this here kamikaze. It was a nice looking ring. And he couldn't get it off, so he chopped the finger off to get the ring. Of course, I thought that was awful. But it was really something. Then they picked up the body and threw the body over the side. It's kind of hard to understand how people could. Oh, I wanted to tell this. You know, on the ship, I thought everybody on this ship, there was 3,000 men, and I thought every one of them was just a wonderful person. But I found out that there was a lot of them that were bad. They went around and they took off watches or anything of value. They'd taken off the dead men for themselves.
And these are the dead Americans, almost 400 of them.
Yes. And that really bothered me. I thought that every guy was a good guy, but that many men, 3,000, there's bad men there too.
Well, I'm sure you saw a lot of things that day that nothing could have prepared you for or that you never wanted to see. And when 390 guys are killed, I imagine there had to be some of those who were guys you knew, guys you'd served with, guys you're around.
There was two of my real good friends that we used to talk at nighttime. Our bunks were together, and so we'd visit back and forth. We'd talk about our hometown and the people in it. And these three guys, there was one guy that him and I, him and I was good friends. He had two children and I had one. And so anyway, we found him in the men's bathroom where he had taken off all the seats. There was a big trough. Men would just sit on these seats, and we never had any partition between us or anything. And this trough would take everything out and empty it into the sea. And this one guy that had two children, he took off all the seats, and he laid down in this trough and put his mouth at the outlet trying to get oxygen so he could live, and that's where we found him dead. And my other two friends, we found them, they were sitting with their legs pulled up close to them and their arms are around their legs, and they were dead, leaning up against the bulkhead there. So I did lose three of my special friends.
And when you see that, and I know, I mean, it's 72 years later now, but even just the thought for you still brings those emotions back like you felt them 72 years ago. As you process through all of that, as you grieve their loss, does there come a point where you also say, that could have been me?
No, I never felt that. I always felt, I guess I just felt like God had me on a mission. And when that mission was over, well, then that would be it. Even now I wonder, 97 years old, and I still wonder if there's a mission.
Well, I think the last year is pretty good evidence that there is. What about after all that, the next day, the days that followed? What did you have to do to clean up the ship, to repair the ship, to honor those who died?
The next day, we had a funeral. They would take four sailors at a time, or sometimes more, and they'd get them ready for burial at sea. And the one thing that they did, they would put a 5-inch cannon shell between their legs to give them weight. And then they would wrap them all up and place them on a stretcher. And they would take them. We had three ministers of different denominations, and they would all give a prayer. And they would drop all these dead sailors overboard with a cannon shell between their legs. But they wanted them to sink to the bottom of the sea.
So when you're on the deck, and you're watching that, and you're seeing guys just like you be buried at sea, and you hear that bugler playing taps, and the minister's saying what they're saying, what kind of things go through your mind?
Well, I was so busy doing things, I didn't want to spend my time there, but I saw some of it. Actually, I had jobs to do, and I wanted my ship to be safe. So I saw them do a couple burials, and they had these three ministers who said a prayer for every group of sailors that they buried at sea. Well, that reminds me of all the airplanes on the deck that didn't burn, and I don't know how, there wasn't too many of them. They cleaned the deck off of everything. They pushed all the ships, all the airplanes, even if they looked good, we pushed them overboard, and we wanted to clean up the whole area and get rid of all the things that could be dangerous. Anything that burned went overboard. But it still looked very bad when you looked at the area, you saw all the smoky equipment and the damage that had been done with the deck where the bombs hit. Well, the deck was pointing to the sky.
And numbers-wise, only the kamikaze attack on the Franklin claimed more lives than this one on the Bunker Hill. Did they give you guys some survivor's leave after that? Or what happened to you guys? Where'd you go from Okinawa?
We went to Pearl Harbor. We had to get some of the things on the ship in ship shape so we could take it back to Bremerton. Oh, the really a special thing happened when we was pulling into Pearl Harbor. We saw a couple of hundred sailors lined up. Yeah, they were all saluting us as we pulled into Pearl Harbor. It was really quite a sight to see all these sailors side by side lined up, and there was an awful lot of them. And they were all saluting. So they gave us respect.
And it's easy to hear how much that still means all these years later. Break time again. When we come back, Al explains what it was like to see his wife and son again, and the incredible phone call he received just in the last year that answered the biggest lingering question from his heroics aboard the Bunker Hill. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Al Skerritt, is pretty amazing. 97 years old, currently battling leukemia, but still in possession of the kind of handshake that leaves an impression, the kind of grip that indicates his hands have been pretty productive throughout his life. He still lives in the house he built. I didn't say the house he had built, but the house he built himself in Seattle decades ago. He spent 25 years with the fire department there. And here's one to remember the next time you have a chance to visit Walt Disney World in Florida. If you go inside Cinderella's castle and inspect the bottom of the shelves, you might just find his signature on some of his handiwork. He spent a year using his carpentry skills to try to put that legendary tourist destination together. That never would have happened if Al did not survive May 11th, 1945, and the kamikaze attack that claimed the lives of 390 men aboard the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill. When we left off, he shared what it meant to see sailors lined up and saluting when the heavily damaged ship crawled into Pearl Harbor. The Bunker Hill's next stop would be the Naval Shipyard in Bremerton, Washington, just miles from where his wife and young son were. His wife, Jean, still didn't know whether Al had survived that kamikaze attack.
My wife's cousin worked at Bremerton, and she heard about the ship coming in. And she called my wife, Jane, and told her that the ship was something after all these years. I still cry.
So, and of all the ports for your ship to come back into, they come back to your home port.
Most of the sailors on board ship came from the East Coast, and they were very disappointed. I know when we were in Bremerton, well, they gave them money, enough money to travel back east and as far as New York. They gave me $3 to ride the ferry back home. Mm-hmm. And
what was that moment like to look into Gene's eyes again?
That was pretty good. Oh, on my way home, I knew I had this son at home. I saw this rocking horse over there in a window, and I thought, I'm going to take that home. So I went and bought this rocking horse, and I put it underneath my arm, and I got on the Rainier Avenue bus that would take me to where Jean was living with her mother, and everybody on the bus was watching me. And so then I told him, I said, I bought this for my son. I said, I just wanted to bring something home to him. And everybody in the bus was, they thought that, they all clapped. It was really something. I was carrying that underneath my arm with a sailor hat on and all that, you know, and so it was quite a picture, I think.
Well, and did he even know who you were when you showed up? Was he looking at your photo on the nightstand all that time or something? I mean, because he hadn't really known you before you went overseas. What was it like when you gave him the rocking horse?
I know my wife and my mother-in-law, they thought it was pretty good. You know, I think he just jumped on the horse and rocked.
And I'm just thinking time-wise, were you still home here in Seattle when the Japanese surrendered?
I was at the Roosevelt Theater downtown, and we came out, and everybody, they were in the streets yelling, you know, the war's over, the war's over. And everybody out in the middle of the street, and it was really something to see that. I kind of wanted to see what it would be like to stay downtown, but here my cousin came by in a car, and he saw us, and he yelled at us, and so he said, come on, I'll give you a ride home. So I didn't get to stay downtown very long, but they were celebrating by jumping up and down, just like the pictures you've seen of New York and that.
Well, that was a long time ago, 72 years, and you guys went on to have two more children. You now have six grandchildren, but over those years, 70 plus years, how often during that time did you think back to your ship and the day it got hit and the events that transpired?
I was so busy with my job. Of course, if something was said about the war, my mind always went back and I had flashbacks of this and that. But I got the most wonderful job in the fire department. I run what they call an aid car, and I was at the beginning of the medic program. And on this aid car, there was four aid cars in the city, and we took care of everything from Ballard to West Seattle. I was really a good aid car man. I'd go to get calls, everything from suicide calls to heart attacks. But all we had was just a car. And if we needed an ambulance, well, I had a two-way radio, and I'd call the radio operator and tell him to send an ambulance out. I feel like I was a pioneer of the medic program. And I rode that aid car for 18 years. And the captain called me one day, and he says, Al, he says, I'm going to send you up to the Harborview Hospital, and they're going to train you to be a, what they call a medic. And I told him, I said, I don't want that job. I said, I've been on this aid car for 18 years, and I just want something else. And he says, well, there's a John Riss. He just retired. Maybe you'd like to have his job driving the tiller in the back of the fire truck. And I said, yes. And so they gave me that job, and it was one of the easiest jobs in the fire department. All you had to do is follow.
Well, it strikes me that in all those years, as you know, running that aid car, you probably had a hand in saving a lot of lives, a lot of people who were alive because of your efforts and the efforts of your fellow firemen. But did you ever, in all those years, think back to that guy you'd pulled out of the engine room on the Bunker Hill and wonder what happened to him?
Of course I thought about that, but it would only be a moment thought. It was really surprising when I got that phone call here at the house.
So about a decade ago, you talked to a writer, Max Kennedy, son of Robert F. Kennedy, who was writing a book about the Bunker Hill and that tragedy. So your story's in that book.
Yes.
And unbeknownst to you, there's a gentleman in Chicago reading that book.
Yeah, well, he called me and he told me that I was the guy that pulled him out of the hole. He says he didn't know. He always wondered who I was until he, and I don't know what took him so long to read this book about Maxwell Kennedy wrote. But it was surprising. And he said he was from Chicago. And that wasn't too long ago when he phoned me. But it was really something.
I know there's a couple parts of your story just in telling it here that have made you feel those emotions all over again. I imagine he said a few things to you when he called you that probably stirred some emotions in you. What did he say to you when he called out of the blue like that?
He just came right out and told me, he says, that guy in the book that you saved from the engine room was me. He says, it's so wonderful that you're still around and I could talk to you. And so then his wife even got on the telephone. Anyway, that was really quite a great moment. And I thought, well, that's a long time between him finding out that that was him. But I guess he never read the book or something.
I mean, of all the things that someone could tell you on the phone, I can't imagine something that would be a bigger surprise or more unexpected than that news that you got. How did it make you feel to know that not only that person survived, but that he's had this long life, and then he starts to tell you about that life that wouldn't have happened without you and your intervention? How did that make you feel to hear all of that?
That really answered my question of who was that guy. I felt good about it.
So you guys have talked on the phone, and I've seen a video where the author of the book, Maxwell Kennedy, came over and sat with you, and you guys did a little Skype session with this gentleman in Chicago, and you could see each other back and forth. But what about meeting in person? Are you guys trying to pull that off?
Well, we talked about that, but he's not well, and so we figured that we just had to stay home, and I'm thankful to know that the guy that I saved is up and about, and he's a little better health than I am. I feel real good that I know the guy that I saved. And I really did save him. But I was young and I was strong and I wasn't emotional like I am now.
You know, I've talked to a lot of guys, hundreds and hundreds of vets who went through things similar to you. Some of them have shared that it's really bothered them over the years, that they see those situations again in their minds, or they wake up in the middle of the night and they're experiencing these flashbacks and all that. Has that happened to you? And if so, how have you handled it? How have you dealt with it?
Seeing that I have had such an interesting job of being a firefighter, and I was in charge of the aid car, well, I had all those things to think about, too. If something was brought up about my ship, of course I'd have a flashback. But it didn't come on in a dream or anything. I had to have something that started me thinking about it again. But when I do think about it, I think about how lucky I am. And I do think about if a certain thing happens, though I do have different thoughts that comes. They'll never go away. I think of them really clear. I'm always thankful.
Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in the other Washington?
No, that's one thing that I felt like I didn't need to be reminded of all those things. And I've been offered several times for them to fly me back there, but I didn't need that. I remember things pretty good about on my ship and all that, and I don't need to be reminded of it going back there. And I do feel that is a real good memorial for all services.
Yeah, 400,000 Americans, 406,000 who died in World War II. And you knew some of them. You came close to being one of them. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something that you would say that you are most proud of or most thankful for?
I am thankful that I got to be a sailor instead of a soldier, although they did their part. And I do think about all the different friends of mine that got killed. I feel like even though I'm still here, I feel like I'm still on a mission. I don't know what my mission is, but maybe it's to tell my story. Maybe it was the beginning of the medic program. I feel like I had a lot to do with the medic program. I'm very thankful that, and then in my church, I had a lot of jobs in my church, Hillcrest Presbyterian Church. I was a deacon in my church. I felt like I did a good job there. I always like one picture that I have. It shows me sitting up on the cross arm of a church. I don't know who took this picture, but I crawled up there to see if I could paint the cross. Sitting up there looking around, I thought, well, that's too dangerous. I can't paint this. I don't know why I thought of that. And so we hired a contractor to come in, and he had a hydraulic lift and paint that cross, but I got a picture in the back room of me sitting on the cross. I'm a man that always liked to do things and not just look at it, but do it.
Here's my last question for you, and if there's anything else you want to add, feel free. But since you're still on a mission and you're a guy who likes to do things, is there anything you haven't done yet that's still on your list that you're hoping to pull off someday?
That's quite a question to answer. Maybe my mission is just to show gratitude and also to tell my story. I even think it's quite a story. Yeah.
And it may not be over yet. I know I said that was the last question, but here's one more. When you think about all those sailors on your ship that died in that attack, how should we remember them now? What's their legacy? What do we need to know about them or remember about them?
I think it would be good to show pictures of that time to know and see how many, and to know about them, how they buried them at sea and all that. And I really feel like they should see some of those scenes where they bury them at sea.
You think by seeing scenes like that, we'll have a better understanding or appreciation of the price that was paid for our freedom?
Oh, definitely. And it shows that we gave them all a Christian burial. If you kind of see that sacrifice that they gave, you appreciate things more.
I think we all heard how much Al sincerely appreciates that sacrifice. And I'm sure you appreciate this 97-year-old as much as I do. As for Norm Lasman, the sailor from Chicago that Al pulled from the engine room 72 years ago, keep your ears open for his story on a future episode of Hometown Heroes. And link to that TV story of their connection and the book that made that connection, Danger's Hour by Max Kennedy, at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for now. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll always remember what Al Skerritt's unique story illustrated so sincerely again today. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.